And welcome to the Transfer Window. This is the podcast that not only takes you inside the biggest deals at the biggest clubs in world football, but brings you insight and analysis on the issues that matter every Monday, Wednesday and Friday. I'm Johnny McFarlane, and joining me are pundits extraordinaire Duncan Castles and Ian McGarry. On today's Transfer Podcast, we reveal the name of the man that could take on the vacant director of football role at Chelsea, and tell you why he may want to think long and hard before committing to the Stamford Bridge club. And it's an often repeated cliche that the Premier League is the best in the world. But is it the season this year that this has become true? We assess the wafer-thin margins in the fight for both the title and Champions League places. We always like to start with a bit of breaking news, and Duncan has a story coming out of Chelsea. What's happening in the west of London?
Well, this Chelsea looking at the recruitment problems, which are obviously very broad scale, given that they're about to have a transfer window ban from FIFA, which they've tried to have suspended unsuccessfully so far. I suspect they'll go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport to challenge FIFA's decision not to give them a suspension while they appeal that ban. But as things stand, they're not going to be able to do anything the next two windows. But this has broader repercussions than just what they can shop for in the coming summer to improve a squad that we can all see has significant problems and who their current manager, if he survives, clearly isn't happy with. They are again looking for a director of football, the post that they didn't replace after Michael Emenalo resigned to go to Monaco in 2017, at the end of 2017. They've been in contact again, as they were at that time, with Luis Campos, who is in charge of recruitment at Lille, second in Ligue 1, was previously in charge of Monaco and was responsible for building the team that took the French title off PSG and got them to the semi-final of Champions League, and also subsequently raised more transfer fee revenue in a single window than any club ever, securing players like Kylian Mbappe be the key example. So Chelsea are unsurprisingly interested in Campos. They've been in conversations with him again. The problem they have is he doesn't want to go to Chelsea unless he knows he has a good chance of succeeding. And I think this is telling about where Chelsea are as a football club, because this was 5 years ago. Chelsea approached technical director at a European club and asked them to come and join them. Not a top tier, an absolute elite European club. I don't think the conversation would go on for very long. They'd be able to hire the guy they wanted. But Campos is highly regarded. There is interest from other clubs. He has been looking to move to the Premier League, or considering a move to the Premier League for some time now, has been approached. He was the man Jose Mourinho recommended to Manchester United to come in to be their first director of football, something Ed Woodward did not want to do, i.e. appoint Mourinho's recommendation for the role. So he is an extremely strong candidate on his track record, but if he moves to the Premier League, he wants to come to a club where he has a chance of success. And his concern isn't just the transfer window ban, which obviously if your specialism is recruitment, you're going to be worried about too, a transfer window ban. It's also where the club is generally, what kind of finances are available, what the structure of the club is, what the plans of the owner are, whether the owner is going to stay on long term. I understand he's looking for reassurance on all of those areas before deciding whether to take it or not. And just to underline, this is very worrying for Chelsea that they're now in a position where potential hires, be they manager, technical director or players, are asking serious questions about what the status of the club is, what their ambitions are, and how likely they are going to be able to succeed in their jobs at the club going forward.
I think this we've already seen an example of this, Duncan, in the January window when Chelsea brought in Gonzalo Higuain, who was already out on loan from Juventus because he wasn't playing well at Juventus. And, you know, his performances have been average at best. He's also, I think he's 30 or 31 now. It just shows you that, you know, how far Chelsea have fallen, if you like, from the state of the elite super rich, which they still are, well, theoretically. But you think, what, 5-6 years ago, they broke their own transfer record in January to buy Fernando Torres, who, if, of course, they'd done their due diligence and found out he did dodgy knee, then they might not pay that amount of money for him. But effectively, they bought one of the best strikers in the world in the January window. And now they're getting on loan a guy who can't even get a game at Juventus. So, and there's no secret in the football world. By that I mean, you know, the people who own, manage, and administer football clubs, that there's a lot of doubt about Roman Abramovich's commitment to the club. He's rarely been seen at games since his visa was revoked by the British government last year, and he obviously took out Israeli citizenship. He's obviously free to travel to and from Britain as he pleases, but obviously the new stadium plan has been shelved. They haven't been investing as much money in players. I think any technical director, anyone, a player even, who moves to Chelsea now would probably want a lot more questions answered than they would have had needed to be answered just, say, 2 or 3 years ago. So it's not surprising. And even the way that the team have been struggled this season, the sort of almost hashed appointment of Sarri to replace Conte. And then, of course, the absolutely bizarre statement from the manager after they salvaged the late draw against Wolverhampton Wanderers at home on Sunday, when he was asked about substituting his pet player, Jorginho, with 20 minutes left. He made the astonishing claim that every other player on the pitch wasn't moving fast enough to suit Jorginho's one-touch play. So he's effectively saying he selected a team around one player. And then when those players, i.e. the other 9 outfield players, weren't moving fast enough off the ball, he was forced to change his system with 20 minutes left. And remember, they're trailing 1-0 at this point. It's just, I mean, that does not sound to me like a sound basis upon which you either select or put a team out to play based on the passing skills, well, what you perceive to be the passing skills and strengths of one player.
We've seen this, obviously, we've seen this dogmatism or idealism, depending on how you want to frame it, from Sarri all season, particularly around Jorginho, but essentially around the tactics, the way the team plays, and a succession of bizarre statements off the back of it. I guess the one positive for Chelsea with Sarri is he at least did substitute Jorginho and change the system and managed to get the equalising goal. And that came after the switch to a kind of old-style defensive counter-attacking football that he decided to implement on the advice of the players after the 6-0 defeat at Manchester City. So it's not much of a sign of hope, but at least he's shown that on two occasions he's prepared to shift away from those great ideals to actually try and get a result, as opposed to just sitting there saying, my way of football is the way, and I'm going to carry on with it until the players learn how to the shining light on the hill, on the Sarri hill, which will guide them to greater glory.
Well, it's a hoary old cliche that the English game and the English top flight is the best in the world, but this season there's inarguable evidence that is living up to that tag. We have an exciting top two title race between Man City and Liverpool, who are duking it out. And then below that, even for the Champions League spaces, there are 4 clubs in the mix, especially so after Arsenal's 2-0 win against Manchester United, which brought them right back into contention. Ian, is this the best Premier League title race that we have seen in a long, long time?
I think it is, Johnny, and I've been covering the Premier League since 2000, and it's unusual to have four teams still in contention for the other two Champions League places, with only 1 point separating the top two as well. Especially with Liverpool being in the mix, you know, the monkey on their back of 29 years without a title, etc. So, yeah, I think it is, and also the actual margin of points is unusual. I Tottenham were in 61 in third place, and then you go down to 57. Chelsea in sixth with a game in hand. So if they beat the Mighty Seagulls in that game in hand against Brighton, then they would be in 60 points as well, level with Arsenal. So yeah, it's, I agree. I think the Premier League is overhyped, and it's overhyped by people in this country about being brilliant. But when you look around Europe as well, you know, who wins the Liga? Well, it's always Real Madrid, Barcelona, Atletico come in and do a Leicester City now and again. But Bayern Munich or Borussia Dortmund usually win the Bundesliga. Obviously, Paris Saint-Germain are about 14 points clear at the top of League A, etc. So, excuse me, and now Juventus also leading in Italy. So it's unusual around Europe to have six teams fighting it out for the what is, I guess, you know, the actual trophy for the top two, and then the Champions League places, which are so important in terms of finance and prestige. So, and again, I think Duncan, Man United probably did slip up a bit yesterday in terms of how they've been playing recently, especially with that first defeat in the Premier League for Solskjaer.
Yeah, look, it certainly opened things up. Man United went into that game thinking if we carry on our our precedented for the club run of away Premier League victories, we'll be level with Tottenham in third place on 61 points. And then they come out of it and they are, you could say, provisionally six, depending on that Chelsea result against Brighton. But, you know, as you say, in a very narrow range, if Chelsea get a draw or a win against Brighton, then you'll have the Tottenham, Arsenal, Manchester United and Chelsea separated by just 3 points with eight games left to play, which, you know, as you say, a fascinating end to the season in store. I think, yes, Sunday's result was an important one for Arsenal and an important one for Manchester United, because Solskjaer was saying after the game, we've won games this season that we didn't deserve to win, and we lost that game when we didn't deserve to lose it. And I understand where he was coming from there, because they created a lot of chances in the match. They chased the game well. They had the body of the play for the second half until Arsenal scored their second goal. But I think you've also got to note that he decided to play conventional 4-4-2 for the second match in a row. Some of that probably forced upon him by limited resources, the players he had fit. But I think also there's an element of it had been the starting formation he'd used against Paris Saint-Germain, and they won that game. So managers often tend to continue with what has brought a win or has been associated with a win in the previous game. But really, against Paris Saint-Germain, that narrow 4-4-2 they played was contributed to Paris having a ton of chances in the first half of the game and was obviously being exploited by Unai Emery. And Solskjaer was forced to switch it before half-time. And the same thing or a similar thing happened at Arsenal. The 4-4-2 wasn't as narrow this time. It was a bit more conventional. But with Arsenal playing wing-backs, as Paris Saint-Germain did, again, there was a huge amount of space being exploited behind Manchester United's right back, and most of Arsenal's chances were coming from there. And I think it was 30 minutes in that Solskjaer decided to change shape to try and halt that. It's a bad sign that you have two consecutive games when your starting system, when you've done your scouting in the opposition, you look at the way you expect them to play. You should have various provisions in place according to what they do, and you are opened up by both teams and have to change shape so early on in the game. There's been some, again, people say, well, he has personnel issues, therefore he's being forced into these shapes. The personnel issues, as we've discussed on the podcast, are in part down to the training and the way he's been selecting players through his time at United and the way he's getting to play. So he's demanding they run more. He's not been rotating the squad a lot. And the first leg of the Paris Saint-Germain game, you got that rash of muscular injuries, three players having to come off before half-time, Matic injured in training the day before the game. It's extremely unusual to have that many muscular injuries in a short period of time. These things add up. And with the tightness now you have for those Champions League places, it could be important in whether Manchester United qualify for Europe from their league position. And I think the next game for Manchester United will be important, because that momentum of winning all your away games in the Premier League, the long domestic unbeaten run, has gone. And now we have to see what the response will be.
We should point out that the quality of this season's Premier League is such, in terms of competition, that Liverpool, after 30 games, have 73 points. No team has ever not gone on to win the Premier League having 73 points after 30 games. But Man City have 74. So this Liverpool are not just sort of, you know, scaling this Mount Everest of 29 years without a first-tier championship win, but they're up against possibly the best ever side to play in the Premier League, given that they actually exceeded 73 points after 30 games.
That's another fascinating thing about this title race, is if we see Manchester City win two in a row and put up extremely high points and goals totals in both of those seasons, then we have to start seriously talking about this Manchester City team being, are they the best Premier League team we've seen? It's fine doing it in one season, but as Guardiola underlined immediately he'd won the title, what he wanted to see was whether the team were capable of retaining the title, and whether they had the mentality and the focus and the ability to put back-to-back Premier League titles together, because for him that's the test of truly great sides and truly great players. And remember, Manchester City, for all the financial backing they've had during the Abu Dhabi era, have yet to win back-to-back titles. So it's another aspect to what is a fascinating end of season, is that history chase and the assessment we make of Manchester City as a football team, as a coaching unit looking after that football team, if they manage to put two together in these circumstances.
Given the situation that's been highly publicised, and we've been talking about it here on the Transfer Window podcast with regards to FFP, Duncan, is there any danger of a comeback? I know in terms of points deductions, that's something that's been mooted on social media. What's the actual situation there?
I think technically there's a danger. They are under investigation from the Premier League. Premier League came out with a formal statement about them investigating Manchester City on the back of UEFA announcing their formal investigation of Manchester City's alleged failure to comply with FFP over past seasons last week. Now, other Premier League clubs have been influential in the Premier League investigating that matter. There's a number of clubs that are unhappy with the way Manchester City have conducted themselves, that are unhappy with the evidence they've seen presented by Der Spiegel and Football Leaks. And they want to see that properly investigated. If it's demonstrated, if Manchester City do not have a coherent defence, then they want to see Manchester City punished, prevented from doing such things in the future. So that tells you there is significant internal pressure for something to happen here. I think you have to frame this in the sense of what the Premier League would want. What does the Premier League want? Premier League wants an exciting competition. They want high broadcast sales. They want to present the Premier League as the best football league in the world, the best football you can watch in the world. Is it in their interests to have a threat of point deductions on a season like this, one we've just been talking about, you know, historic season, which is so fascinating? It's probably not in their interest to have that. I think if in the Premier League's ideal world, the whole thing would go away and they wouldn't have to deal with it. But I'm not sure it is going to go away. If that investigation brings forward grounds for penalising Manchester City, you have to say there is a very good chance that that will be the case, particularly if UEFA carry through their action, carry through what several people inside UEFA want to happen, which is for Manchester City to be banned from the Champions League. If that happens, the Premier League is going to be under huge pressure to do something itself. If any of the transgressions UEFA find Manchester City guilty of are also transgressions of the Premier League rules, which are different. They're not, you know, there are a lot of areas which will not potentially transgress Premier League rules that will transgress UEFA financial fair play rules. But if that happens, then the Premier League are going to be forced to act. What I would expect is that it will not be retrospective. It would be, at worst, a points deduction which would be applied to them going into a forthcoming season. So let's say a decision comes over the summer, then a points penalty would be applied to Manchester City by the Premier League, so they start on -3, -6, -9. I'm just making up numbers here, but that is the way I would see the Premier League acting if they are forced to act by the evidence and by other member clubs.
Yeah, and that's the worst case scenario. What's the likelihood in your view?
Well, the first thing I'd say, it's true that Premier League have their own investigation going on. So you've got to be clear for everyone that there's an investigation in England from the Premier League and also an investigation being conducted by UEFA from Switzerland. So it's almost like the Premier League has been, you know, hiding their head in the sand over this, because it's in their interest to make sure that every club under its tutelage and under its administration complies with both the financial fair play rules set down by UEFA as a governing body and also by themselves. So what have the Premier League been doing for the last 5 years? And why has it taken an external investigation by UEFA to actually bring this to light 2 or 3 years later? It's really quite bizarre. I agree with Duncan. I think that it's more likely that UEFA will punish Manchester City and that the Premier League will quite happily leave it to UEFA to punish them, because they don't want to be seen to be, obviously, you know, in some way hurting or injuring one of the major clubs in this country by points deduction. So I suspect it would at worst be a Champions League ban. At best for Manchester City, it might be a suspended ban based on their future conduct.
The Premier League could go down the Serie A route, which was when the Calciopoli Juventus had titles stripped of them in the past. And in some ways, that's kind of the safer route, because those titles were awarded to Inter, but no one really, I don't think they're really perceived as being Inter's titles. I think even when clubs have league titles stripped for them for breaking the rules, the perception is that they won them on the field of play. Whether that be right or wrong, I think my feeling is the general perception is they won them on the field of play. So Marseille won the European Cup and were shown to have cheated in that European Cup. They're still perceived to be the winners of that year's European Cup. So, you know, Premier League could have the option of saying, OK, you broke the rules in the past, we're going to take that title away from you. And then sort of stick this transgression into history and let people argue about who won the title that year or not. Could do that.
Well, but there are precedents set in Scotland, obviously, when Rangers were, you know, basically demoted three divisions and people called for them to be stripped of titles, and it didn't happen, Duncan. And, you know, given that the UK basically make up most of IFAB, then I think you're right. I think the perception is always that it's almost like the spirit of the competition prevails. So the
even if the spirit of the competition's been completely broken, it's ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is an anachronism, but that is the perception, I think, of people. And I think that's one of the reasons why Rangers weren't stripped of those titles, because I think the SFA had a look at it and thought, what's the point? You know, and of course, it was mainly Celtic fans who were calling for them to be stripped of the titles anyway. So again, that's what you're saying about what Liverpool might tend to do. Well, I don't think they've got any grounds basically to ask for City to be deducted points. So I think it's an interesting point of contention, but I don't see it coming to pass.
It should. I mean, it should be said here: Liverpool are owned by Americans, as are a number of Premier League clubs, and I think part of the reason why these Premier League clubs are putting pressure on the league to take action against Manchester City is the owners are used to operating in American sports. Quite a lot of these owners also own major American football or baseball franchises ice hockey, basketball. And American sports is extremely heavily regulated in terms of...
And also transparent in every way, Duncan. You can
see... Yes.
What any NBA, NFL player earns, what his contract is. You can go onto the website of the governing body and you can check the contract details right down to the last cent. Can you imagine that happening in the Premier League?
Yeah, but the reason is because they have salary caps and they're limited in how much money they're allowed to spend on players. And competition is that the competition to win titles is done within that framework. But the Americans are accustomed to, you have a set of league rules. Those league rules are sacrosanct. If clubs break them, they get punished. So they can't understand why Manchester City, when this amount of evidence is already in the public domain, are not under severe investigation from the Premier League. Just one last thing on this. We've had a lot of talk since Pep Guardiola came to the club about Manchester City doing the quadruple. They've actually done the quadruple. They're currently under investigation by the Football Association, the Premier League, FIFA and UEFA, which I think is unprecedented in football.
How long have you waited to get that one in, Duncan?
Well, it's come to that time again where we do Heroes and Villains, our round that looks at the weekend's action and gives you the people that we think deserve a little bit of shine, a little bit of polish, and to have their names dragged through the mud. So we're going to start off with you, Ian, with our hero.
So in a weekend of football, there's a lot to be ashamed about, Johnny. I'm glad I got the hero to nominate. And for me, Sadio Mane. I wouldn't say he's underrated at Liverpool, because that would be silly. But he's definitely understated. You know, he doesn't get as much of the headlines as Mo Salah does. Bobby Firmino seems to be this cult figure who, you know, holds babies on the bench, etc., etc. And all the time, Sadio Mane just goes about his job. He's lightning fast. The two goals he scored, especially the first one, he nicks in the top corner on Sunday, it was just beautiful to watch. And I think he's possibly, and people haven't even mentioned him, and that says something itself, as a footballer of the year, I think he should be a main contender.
Duncan? What's your pick for the villain of the weekend?
I think it's very easy this weekend, sadly. I think it's Paul Mitchell, the Birmingham City fan, who ran on their pitch and assaulted Jack Grealish of Aston Villa. And I think not only is he the villain, I think the Birmingham City fans who then cheered him for doing so are also the villains of the week. And it's I think it's a terrible precedent, we have to be very careful in football that this is pinned down as quickly as possible, because you've got to say that if this becomes fashionable, if we have supporters encouraging each other to run on the pitch and attack opposition players and getting status off the back of it, we've got a serious problem in the game, because every game is under threat of it. The way grounds are set up in England and Scotland, it's so easy to get access to the pitch.
Okay, it's time to wrap this particular transfer window up on that rather sad and downbeat note. But fear not, we'll be back on Wednesday to answer your questions. To continue the debate, we are all on Twitter and even have our own transfer window official account at Transfer Podcast. If you want to talk to me, I'm at Johnny R. McFarlane. But more importantly, if you want to talk to the guys, they're happy to respond. And they are at GarboSJ for Ian and at Duncan Castles for Duncan. If you like the podcast, and we know thousands of you do, give something back by popping onto iTunes and giving us a 5-star review, as this helps us reach as many listeners as possible. Until Wednesday, thanks for listening.